Before I tell you my story of how God first took over the life of my husband, and then between the two of them conspired and eventually overwhelmed mine, I have something to just say to all of you here in Morgantown. Thank you. As representatives of Gospel Missions, my colleagues and I are here at this Morgantown breakfast for the 27th time. Who would have thought?
Really? Has it been 27?
27.
Wow!
I can't believe it myself.
Wow.
We have been here for every breakfast this chapter has held. And I can tell you that we have enjoyed the heck out of every single event.
Thank you.
Pat is always gracious in thanking us, as she did again today. But the thanks go both ways, because we have been able to become acquainted with so many of you who have become our regular customers, and those of you who don't shop with us at all. And by the way, give it a shot, will you? Come on. It's a lot of work. And we look forward to seeing you each and every time. Your wonderful support of our store and of us is extremely helpful. It helps us tremendously, and you have our heartfelt gratitude.
Thank you.
So now, I was going to apply for you, but I'll be the only one. So, and now about that story. It's a tale of two persons. In one time, about 20 years ago, when I was coerced into doing something just like this. I have to talk to you all. I was coerced into doing something like this, a very short talk that I agreed to do. And I called that talk Survival of Spousal Conversion. And as I was writing that down again to prepare this speech, I thought, that's not true. That's the wrong title. So I have to think of another one. But I think it's more like The Most Blessed Person Alive. So let me just start. I'll tell you that I was born in 1947. For those of you who know that far back, that was a long time ago. Not, of course, as long as 100, but close enough. My parents were pioneers in the delayed marriage and birth phenomenon that is pretty much standard today. My mother was 31 years old. My father was 30 when I was born. Of course, World War II got in the way. That was the problem. But they made up for that with all that lost time with a lot of speed. By the time I was 7 and a half, I had 3 younger sisters and 2 younger brothers.
Wow.
So 6 of us under 7 and a half at one time. So 8 of us. And there were 2 more to come, by the way, a couple of years later. 8 of us kids, all told. So you can tell my parents took their religion very seriously. My mother had been raised Catholic. She was the oldest of 15. But my father converted to Catholicism because in order to be able to marry my mother in the Catholic Church, it was he had to convert because it was non-negotiable back in those days. Together, they raised us as good little Catholics, sending us to Catholic school in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania, run by the Sisters of Mercy. My class was huge. We had 80 first graders in my class in one room with a little Mercy nun who had just been a nun for about a year. It was amazing.
She's a saint now.
She is a saint now. Her name was Saint Christopher. You can pray to her. I mean, Sister Christopher. I'm sorry. And it was amazing. We were baby boomers, of course, so we led the trend. Toward the end of fifth grade, the nuns decided to even out the classroom populations. So I was one of 10 who were chosen to skip the sixth grade. So sure, that sounded like a great idea at the time, but in retrospect, really not that great. Academically, wasn't a problem, but socially, much tougher. For the rest of my life, I would be known as the youngest person in the room. So to make my life even more difficult, my parents decided to move. Right then, just after I had gotten into seventh grade and just barely had, established a friendship at all. And we had to start all over in a new school, a new parochial school in Canonsburg. But we had to do that at the last 2 months of the year. So, you know, it was just kind of difficult. And those nuns taught much differently than the Mercy nuns did. It's more memorization than the theory of thinking and understanding what you're talking about and what you're learning. And true, my classmates soon found out that I was by far the youngest person in the class. And kids can be heartless, as you well know, and you don't even want to know what my nicknames were. I was bullied, I guess, maybe. I don't know. From St. Patrick, then it was off to Immaculate Conception High School in Washington, Pennsylvania. It was only 11 miles going straight there to Washington from Canonsburg, but via the school bus, it took us an hour every day to get there and an hour back. So there were many days, though, that I was very thankful for that ride because that's where I got my algebra homework done. I borrowed that homework from my good friends who liked and were better at algebra than I was. So again, Sisters of Mercy. Daily, though, at that school, we got real religion classes. Right and wrong had definitions. Sin was discussed. And if not careful, there was still a possibility of finding oneself on the road to hell. So they were good. And never did I have in mind then that I would go to college. My parents instilled that it wasn't really a goal. It was more like a destiny somehow. It's like never was a question. But I was only 16 years old when I graduated from high school. And I was anxious about leaving home. My parents, especially my mother, had lofty plans for my college career, and they chose a bunch of schools. One was St. Mary's College in Notre Dame. One was the University of Santa Clara in California. Another one was University of Dayton in Ohio. And they were all Catholic schools, of course, because my parents were focused on that. But not ready to venture so far away, I chose to enroll at Mount Mercy, a Catholic women's college in Pittsburgh. So I roomed there, but because it was an hour from home, but I roomed there. But it was safe, because I was close enough. If I needed anything, they could be there. And Mercy was fine, but do you see what I mean about skipping that grade not being the best idea? I played it safe, and I was too young to go for a bigger challenge. So who knows? I might have been present or something.
Probably.
I could have, if I'd have had a little more courage.
Yes.
I would have
voted for you, Mary.
So those 4 years at Mount Mercy, which was 1964 to 1968, the big Beatles years, were years of upheaval and chaos, perhaps four of the most tumultuous years that our country has known. Among those problems were the Vietnam War, the civil rights marches, burning cities, the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, and more. And at the same time, there was a radical change occurring on the campus of Mount Mercy. In 1964, when I started, there were rules for everything: when you could go, when you could come, who could go to your room, what you wore to dinner, what you wore on campus, everything. By 1967-68, that school year, there were no rules. They were gone. We could do anything we wanted whenever. We were thrilled, of course. It felt like we'd been freed from jail. And it was just a weird thing. And Vatican II then came along and let the nuns dress in, take out of their habits and wear suits and things. And it was just the whole world just seemed turned upside down. It was very unsettling time in this country and in the world. And I think we're still living with the consequences of that today. Finally, though, graduation. Freedom, independence, no more parental guilt trips or lectures, and I had no one to answer to but myself. I apparently never gave having to answer to God a second thought. Because right then, everything connected to the practice of religion in my life stopped. Including, but not limited to, going to Mass, going to confession, saying the rosary, all of that stuff, gone. And this from a girl who started a rosary club in the first grade. Do you see how many rosaries we could all say during recess every day? So, what can I say? My first job was with Gulf Oil Corporation, which was headquartered in Pittsburgh at the time. And that entailed me driving all over the country. But by the time I got out of college, I was ready to take the leap. So driving all over the country, in all 48 states and even Puerto Rico. And as a matter of fact, the woman who hired me 50 years ago attends the Magnificat breakfast in Pittsburgh.
Oh, wow.
I saw her one day, I nearly fell over. And she looks the same as she did then. Wow. So, and besides those experiences, the other bonus to that job was the fact that I was rarely able to visit home because I was traveling so much. So Mom and Dad were none the wiser about the fact that I departed from the practice of my faith. So then I'd only been with Gulf Oil for about 8 months when I received a phone call from the Director of Alumni Relations at Carlo College. Now, this was the new name of Mount Mercy, which they had changed just the days before I got that phone call. So imagine my surprise, Carlo College. It was like, oh, Mount Mercy College no longer existed. So, but the real surprise was that the alumni director was calling to ask me to interview for her position. Could I get to Pittsburgh that weekend for the interview? So I said, I had to wonder about how this could possibly be happening. It wasn't even a year since I graduated from that college, and I was 21 years old. How could they offer me that job? So the biggest surprise of all is that I ended up getting the job. Now I needed a place to live. So, because I'd been traveling around for a year, no place to live. So I knew that Shadyside was the place to look for an apartment. And I found a fellow Mercy graduate who needed a roommate. And I was set. Nice apartment, close to work, bars and clubs galore. We had a ball. A few months later, in October, I was at my favorite hangout called the Casbah, listening to a singing duo that I just loved. I had a date that night, but it wasn't working out all that great. So I abandoned him for a bit and went up to the bar to get myself a beer, since he was obviously not going to do it. So I'd get it myself. So, and by the strangest coincidence, or what we later called a Christ incidence, I sat down at the bar next to a guy who told me his name was Tom Rutkowski. So have any of you ever heard Tom speak or read his books? Yeah, a few of you anyway. We talked a bit while waiting for that beer, and to impress me, he pulled out a business card that said he was the director of photography for WPGH-TV Channel 53 in Pittsburgh. Having lived away from Pittsburgh for almost a year, I had no idea what WPGH-TV was. There was no Channel 53 when I went on the road. So, of course, he had to tell me all about it. So my beer probably got warm, I don't know. It happened that we were both invited to the same party that night. There, Tom and I ended up talking again, and my date was out of it. I don't even know what happened to him, to tell you the truth. He could still be there for all I know.
Waiting for you.
Yeah, waiting for me, where is Mary? So there, Tom and I attended, we were invited to the same party. Tom and I ended up talking again, and my date was out of it. And I needed a ride back to my apartment, and Tom was happy to oblige, of course. So as I was getting out of his car, he asked me for my phone number. I said, I don't think so. But he persisted. One of Tom's greatest virtues. Is that a virtue? I don't know.
Maybe so.
But he persisted. He seemed very nice. He was good looking. He was polite. Eventually, I pulled a piece of paper out of my purse and wrote down the number. But it wasn't my number. He just wasn't my type. However, if you think about it, my clever ruse didn't really work. Why? Because he knew where I lived. He just dropped me off there. So not so long after that, I noticed him sitting on the front steps to my building when I got home from work every night. I got tired of trying to get past him several times a week, so I finally gave in and went out with him just so I could get rid of him in the proper way, It was a challenge. anyway, I guess I must have, he must have steadily grown on me, because a year and a half later, we were still dating, and someone, sometime in 1971, we decided to get married. For the first time, we realized that getting married was going to be a far bigger challenge than we had bargained for. The reason for that is that Tom had been, was a divorced man, and this was not going to be easy. Coming from a huge Catholic family, I could not marry a divorced man, even though his marriage had happened under very strange circumstances. My family was not happy about this, especially my father, who said to me, "How can a divorced man have any respect for women?" That was an old-time reaction, if I ever saw it. You wouldn't hear that today, I don't think. But they all liked Tom very much, but this was a situation they just couldn't handle. This was going just a step too far. So our only hope was for Tom to seek an annulment. We had several appointments with the assistant pastor of my home parish, and that priest assured us that he would help us, that he would show us the procedures and how to go about this whole thing. The problem was, we never heard from him again. No matter whether we called, no, nothing. There was no follow-up. And we were running out of time, because my mother was terminally ill with breast cancer that had been discovered 10 years earlier. And I wanted that wedding to happen while my mother could still be a part of it. And that was a pretty big dilemma. So what do I do now? Well, I pretty much took the easy way out, because by this time, I've been away from church for a few years, and my commitment level was what you might call minimal. And I felt let down by the lack of follow-through from my parish. So I just decided to say, the heck with it. If that's how the church, if that's how much the church cared, if that's how much they wanted us back, then forget it. If the church didn't need me, I certainly didn't need the church. Good thing I didn't die right then. Boy, I believe Tom was a good man, and I was going to marry him, with or without the church. And so we were married on January 22nd in 1972 in a Baptist church by a Protestant KDKA radio evangelist. Half of my Catholic relatives did not show up, and that hurt me, and because my family was very close. But that hurt passed. All those relatives got over it eventually, and so did I. And even my father kind of came around. And then, unless it was Christmas or Easter, we never really gave the church another thought. Shortly after we were married, Tom was offered a job as a videographer for KDKA-TV. I was still with Carlo at the time, and Tom and I lived a fairly normal life. We had our ups and downs. We discovered how completely different we were in most everything. He liked deer hunting. I liked musical theater. Not really close. He liked perpetual motion vacations. I loved lying still on the beach. I forgave easily. He held grudges. So we bought a 27-acre farm with a barn and a rundown 100-year-old farmhouse that we had to restore in Evans City, PA. He was the country mouse, and of course, I was the city mouse. But we made it happen. Fast forward 10 years, and Tom was the chief videographer at KDKA and the union shop steward. I was the national director of advertising for 2,000 general nutrition centers. And there was no God in our lives. But God had plans. One of Tom's most exciting and dangerous assignments was in 1982, following Senator Arlen Specter on a tour of the war-torn country of Lebanon, followed by a trip to Israel to interview Prime Minister Menachem Begin. The night before they left to return home, a stranger approached Tom while he was having dinner with the crew. The stranger asked him if there was anything he would like to have seen that he had not seen. Trying to dismiss the man politely, Tom said, "Yeah, Bethlehem, Christmas and all that." The man said, "Come, I'll take you there." And Tom went. He went. They've been told not to trust strangers. Don't go anywhere. He went. I still don't understand that. They were only in Bethlehem, though, for a short time. When his feet touched the streets of Bethlehem, Tom had a strong emotional reaction and began to cry. He felt electricity run through his body, and he felt something very powerful in Bethlehem. But he went home, and he promptly forgot all about it. In the meantime, 10 years of carrying as much as 80 pounds of video and sound equipment every day in all sorts of circumstances, including dangling out of a flying helicopter, were causing some serious back and joint problems for him. Diagnosed as rheumatoid arthritis, Tom began taking a drug that lessened the pain but put his kidneys in danger. It was called Feldene. The pain was so strong he was willing to take the risk. And then life went on. So in 1984, I was a contestant on a game show called Tic-Tac-Toe. I won cash, I won a car, and I won a trip to Greece, which we took in September of 1985. It was a great trip, and Tom developed wanderlust. He was hooked. It was the only activity, though, that he could pursue that didn't cause him severe pain. So that's part of the, I'm sure, part of the attraction. But still glowing with memories of Greece, Tom then suggested to his uncle and friend Dean that they take a trip to Europe that year instead of their annual fishing trip, which they had done forever. And he had 6 weeks of vacation, so he could do it. His buddies agreed, and just a few weeks after returning from Greece, he was off again on another odyssey. Just fine. I was home. I was still home. Driving a rented motorhome, they checked off 8 different countries. But due to a special request from Dean to see a very out-of-their-way Barcelona, Spain, Tom had to drive back to Paris on the winding back country roads through the Pyrenees Mountains. Not far into France, they passed the remote town of Lourdes. Now, this was something Tom's Catholic Uncle Stanley just had to see. Tom was not happy, but he gave in to his uncle's request. He found Lourdes beautiful, but sort of hokey. He said all the hanging crutches and all the other signs of healing reminded him of televangelist healers. He just couldn't accept what Lourdes was supposed to be all about. But just to hedge his bet, he lifted his hands up to heaven and said to God, "Hey, in case I'm wrong." Like that was going to save him. And at that moment, he felt the same emotion and electricity running through him as he'd felt in Bethlehem. And as the tears started to roll down his cheeks, and he ran to the grotto to hide from his buddies. He didn't want them to see him crying. And while there, he tried to say a short prayer, but he didn't know how to pray. And once home, again, he completely forgot about what happened at Lourdes. Now, it's the next year, September of 1986. Time for another vacation, which meant time to go back to Europe. This time, the crew was his friend Dean from the last trip, a reporter friend Bill Flanagan from KDKA, and yours truly. I got to go. We visited Portugal, Spain, and Morocco and had wonderful experiences in each. Our two friends had only 2 weeks to spend there, but Tom and I had 3. So we bade them goodbye, and we headed for Madrid. Now, I was a Spanish major in college, and Madrid was a dream come true for me, especially to visit one of the world's great museums, El Prado. Tom lasted about an hour there before he tried to get me out of there. I was annoyed because he was cutting short my time. I wanted days there, not just an hour. And in reality, it was his arthritis that was making him tired and miserable, and I didn't know that. So we argued about what to do. And then we stopped speaking to each other because we were getting nowhere. Desperate for relief from an unpleasant situation, Tom suggested we get in a car and drive to the Bordeaux wine country of France. I relented, not seeing any other way out, and we had 2 very lovely days there. On the way back to Portugal, we decided to take a different route than the trip north so we could see more of the country of Portugal. This change in our plans altered the trip significantly, because as Tom was driving over the mountainous hairpin turns and winding roads again, we ran into a torrential rainstorm. Driving was hazardous, and visibility was near zero. The tension generated by these conditions increased by the atmospheric low-pressure system caused Tom's muscles to spasm, causing him excruciating pain. He turned to me and he said, "Well, that it was impossible for him to continue driving." In a small town, we found a hotel so that he could rest. And after taking extra Feldene and sleeping for a couple of hours, he felt better, so we went for a local drive. We passed a sign that read, Fatima, 10 kilometers. Tom asked if that was the Fatima the church talked about. How did he know that? I answered that it must be. Fatima's in Portugal somewhere. He said, do you want to go? I said, nah, not really. He said, okay, I don't either. Well, as we were leaving the next morning, we passed that Fatima sign again. Tom said, it seems a shame to miss seeing such a famous place. He just wanted to add Fatima to the list of famous places that Tom visited. So he said, let's take a quick drive just to see what it's like. I don't remember why, but even though it was cold and raining, we got out of the car and somehow we got separated. Tom found himself inside the glassed-in building that houses the statue of Our Lady of Fatima. He went up to the statue and threw out his arms to her and he said, hey, it's me again. Then he said, then that powerful sensation of electricity flowing through his veins happened again. And again, he began to cry. When we finally found each other at the car, I told him I'd gotten choked up back there and that I even got tears in my eyes. Amazingly, he said to me, so did I. But that visit with the Blessed Mother didn't change anything. Back home again, except for Tom's arthritis, things were going okay. Until late October, when we lived on our boat, which felt like a vacation every weekend. Then Uncle Stanley caught us at home one day with a question and a newspaper. He said, Tom, remember Lourdes? Tom said, yeah, Blessed Virgin Mary appearing to some kids. Why? Stanley said, same thing is happening in this place in Yugoslavia called Medjugorje. Tom was in no mood for this. He laughed and he said to Stanley, you don't really believe that stuff, do you? Uncle Stanley said, well, you just have to read this paper. Tom said, okay, but he knew he probably wouldn't because of his dyslexia. He hadn't read a book since high school, probably not even then. And Stanley left the paper on the table and he went home. When Tom finally picked up that paper, he was amazed to be able to read it. It was full of apparitions and images and miracles. He didn't believe a word of it, but wow, what a great news story this would make. So the next day he approached the news director at KDKA with his idea, and she said, the Pope is coming to the United States next month, and that's all the Catholicism we need for this rating period. So much for that. Tom was disappointed, of course, but he kept trying. He wanted that free trip to Yugoslavia. Next, he found a radiologist at a Pittsburgh hospital named Pat Geinzer, who was quitting his job to become a priest, all because of the visit he made to Medjugorje. Tom asked if he was willing to do an interview for a story he was going to putting together. And Pat said, yes, but only if you read this book, so that you have some idea of what you're asking me about. The book was The Queen of Peace Visits Medjugorje. He decided to let the reporter Bill Flanagan read the book. Tom took his new idea back to the news director and still no dice. But he never gave the book to Bill Flanagan to read, mainly because he couldn't find it. Not long afterwards, Tom was waiting on our boat at the yacht club for his drinking buddies to show up. And he was bored, and he was looking for something to do. He looked down the seat, and there was that book. He decided to pick it up and take a look. For the third time, he discovered he could actually read it. Whatever was helping him to read these things seemed to only work on religious materials. I can't explain it. He read all the way to the third chapter of that book when a voice spoke to him and said, Thomas, I took you to Bethlehem. I took you to Lourdes, and I took you to Fatima. Can't you understand that this is real? There was no question in his mind that it was Jesus speaking to him. All of a sudden, he knew where he stood with God, because all of his sins had become apparent to him, and he felt a burning sensation to go to confession. He ran off that boat, he got into his car, and he went to search for the closest Catholic church he could find. He didn't know what to look for. He was looking for steeples, because that's all he knew about Catholic churches. So he was looking for steeples, so he finally found one, and the resident priest agreed to hear his first confession in 27 years. Tom said, Father, can we just go over the big stuff? Because if we don't, we're going to be here all day. And the priest said, sure, Tom, no problem. Tom now had this burning desire to receive Holy Communion. He asked the priest if he could receive the Eucharist. However, there was that big stumbling block. There was that marriage in the Catholic Church, and then a divorce problem that we had overlooked basically for the past 15 years. Father said it would take a special dispensation from the bishop. So he did it. And the dispensation was actually issued, but there were conditions, including immediately applying for that annulment to that marriage. And Tom eagerly agreed with that. Now, still trying to get KDK to send him to Yugoslavia, Tom heard about a woman named Rita Klaus, who had received a miracle healing through Medjugorje. He just had to find her. Preparing to do a huge search, he found out pretty quickly that she lived in her own town, Evan City. Tom got her phone number right away from her church and called her. They arranged to meet at her home, which turned out to be less than a mile from our farm. Rita had multiple sclerosis and had been confined to a wheelchair for years. The miracle came from a simple prayer to the Blessed Mother of Medjugorje. The prayer, she said, was, "Help me, Blessed Mother of Medjugorje, help me in my unbelief." Gradually, over 2 days, she could walk. Tom was ecstatic. He's thinking, KDK can't possibly turn this down. And so he asked Rita if she would be willing to tell her story on TV. Her answer was no, definitely not. It would cause too many problems. People would be after her constantly. They would challenge her. She would have no peace. Tom said, "How can you hide like that? If I had a miracle like that happen to me, I'd stand on my roof and shout what Jesus did for me." Well, it worked. She agreed to do it. After this meeting with Rita, and having read The Queen of Peace Visits Medjugorje, Tom decided he had to get to this Medjugorje place, even if he had to pay for the ticket himself. Uncle Stanley was just as eager to go with him to Medjugorje as Tom was eager to get there. After all, he's the one who started it all with that newspaper. They planned to visit Medjugorje for a day or two and as many other countries as they could squeeze in. They headed for Medjugorje first. As they got close, Tom's heart began to pound. He was now convinced that something miraculous was happening there. Parking near St. James Church, they had to find the woman with whom they were to stay. They had no idea. So Tom had been given her name, but he couldn't pronounce it. It was Yugoslavian. Approaching a man in a brown habit coming out of St. James, Tom said, "Excuse me, sir, do you speak English?" The man, who was a Franciscan priest, said, "Of course I do," with a heavy accent. Tom said, "Can you help us find this woman?" His agent had sent a photograph of the woman to make finding her easier for them. Once again he heard, "Of course I can. That is Yelena, and that is me standing right beside her." Can you imagine? He turned out to be the pastor of St. James Parish. He arranged for his friend to guide Stanley and Tom to the house where they would be staying. Another Christ incident. And by the time they got to the house, it was late and it was dark. But all Tom could think about was getting to the top of Mount Križevac, or Cross Mountain. That book he'd read said the Blessed Virgin Mary prayed at the foot of that cross every single day. He just had to get there. And now, he slipped out of the house, telling no one where he was going. He managed to find the base of that mountain, and he started up that steep, rocky hill in pitch blackness. Climbing that mountain is very difficult, even in the daylight. And he was plenty frightened at times with strange sounds and howls and thumping noises and getting lost a few times off the beaten path. Well, it really wasn't beaten. It would more beat the people up than the path was beaten. But he made it. God or his mother had to be guiding him every step of the way. Once alone at the top, he knelt at the foot of the cross for over an hour and told Jesus all the sins that he didn't get to tell in his first confession. Once again, in revealing his sins, he realized how far astray he had gone, and he dissolved into just torrents of tears. Finally, he fell asleep on the rocky ground, all the while talking to Jesus. He woke up the next morning, feeling like a new human being. He started down the mountain, and his description, the happiest man on the face of the earth. Going down the mountain, it was hard to believe what he was seeing. The only path on the mountain consisted of massive boulders in treacherous terrain. He could have never gotten up there on his own. And then he met a very annoyed Uncle Stanley halfway down. He had some explaining to do. The one message from the Blessed Mother that really stuck with Tom was this. I come to tell you that God exists. If you want to proclaim the existence of God in your life, go to Mass every day. Say 15 decades of the Rosary every day. Fast on bread and water on Wednesdays and Fridays. Go to confession once a month and have conversion of the heart every day. Tom's reaction to that, are you kidding me, Blessed Mother? We're busy people. How can we find the time to do that? Well, the next day, due to circumstances completely beyond his control, Tom found that he had said 30 decades of the Rosary and been to Mass twice. It was like the Blessed Mother was saying to him, Thomas, I've already proved you wrong. Now just go home and do half of that. It gave him much to think about. Tom had brought a camera with him, of course, as a videographer, and he wanted desperately to do an interview with Witzka and Maria, two of the visionaries, which he did. The interviews only made his desire to be present for one of the apparitions even stronger, 10 times stronger. He presented his case to Father Slavko, who was the visionary's spiritual director, and he finally won him over, and he was admitted that very night to the apparition in the choir loft of St. James Church then, at that time. And then the miracle, the Medjugorje experiences kept happening and kept intriguing Tom and Stanley, so 1 or 2 days' stay turned into 7. But on the evening of the 4th day, Uncle Stanley saw that there was to be a healing service at St. James Church. Now, Tom didn't believe in healing services, so Stanley had to use a bit of guilt about always leaving him alone to get Tom to go with him. Sure, Tom believed in Rita Klaus's healing, but geez, that was one in a million. On this 4th day, Tom's arthritis was unbelievably painful. The church was packed, and there was a priest in the front asking everybody to join together, saying, put your left hand on the right shoulder of the person next to you. And now, with all of us connected as a community of God, let us all offer our heartaches, pain, and sorrow to Jesus Christ. Take what you have wrong with you and offer it to Jesus. Well, to be a good sport, Tom obliged, although he felt it was all very silly. And the man next to Tom put his hand on Tom's shoulder, and it was agonizing for him. He had stopped taking Feldene just as soon as he arrived in Medjugorje, so it was 4 days later, and he has no idea why he did this. By the 4th day, the pain was just very bad. So Tom said to Jesus, Lord, I'm sorry, I can't buy into this. Can I just bow my head and say a few prayers? The pain got worse. The second time, he asked Jesus to give what he might get to someone who needed it more than he did. And the pain got much worse. It was so bad that tears were running down his face. He hurt so much that it brought him to finally say, Jesus, if it were possible for you to take this pain away, please take it away. And just like that, in a flash of a second, the pain was gone. It was as if a light switch was turned off, and Tom never again took another Feldene. But there's more. His dyslexia was gone for good, no matter what he was reading, and a wart on his right hand, and his hemorrhoids disappeared, which is a big bonus. He kept saying, Lord, why are you doing this to me? What do you want from me? I know what hard work is. I can take it, so just tell me and I'll do it. But he heard nothing. And then it was time to leave that wonderful place. Time to see Poland, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Hungary. Next stop, home. Tom had a great desire to tell the world what was happening in his life, but he was afraid of what KDK would say, afraid he would sound crazy, afraid he would lose his job. But he began to live the Blessed Mother's list of practices to proclaim that God exists. Daily Mass, 15 decades of the Rosary, fasting on Wednesday and Friday, monthly confession. And he loved the Divine Mercy and the Pieta Prayer Book, things which I'd never heard of. And he grew in faith. As he grew in faith, he was finding happiness that he had never known. Material things no longer held the first place in his heart. But he was always asking Jesus, what do you want from me? I know there's no free ride, but still no answer. Until one day, he was reading a book, and a paragraph jumped off the page Adam. And it said, I, Jesus Christ, work miracles. But a miracle on the body is only a manifestation of divine power. The saving of souls is the work of Jesus Christ. And I think, and I'm not mistaken, that those who have been saved by me will go out and bring me multitudes. He thought, that's what you want from me, Jesus? I'm a photojournalist, not an evangelist. He was positive he could not do it. He fell apart in front of crowds. Talking to Jesus, he said, you want me to tell people that you speak to me? I've got news for you, Jesus. I will never do that. Okay, you've got to watch what you promise. Sorry that he had to say no to Jesus. He wanted to make up for it and show how much he appreciated everything Jesus was doing for him. So he made a promise to take 100 people to Medjugorje to say thank you. He reserved 100 airline seats with a cash deposit for June of 1989, the next year. He began to promote the pilgrimage, but only a few were signing up. He was worried, but Jesus and his mother stayed with him, and the miracles and the Christ incidences kept happening. Meanwhile, as Tom grew closer to God, I grew farther away from Tom. This was serious because Tom was expecting God to fix everything between us, but that did not happen. I felt displaced and I was unhappy. And he was changing all the rules that we set when we got married or that we lived by during the past 15 years. He tried so hard to make me feel what he felt, but the harder he tried, the more I resisted. And Jesus did a little intervention for me there, reminding Tom of how patient he was with him after Bethlehem, Lourdes, and Fatima. And he asked, why are you pushing your wife? So Tom backed off and life got a little better. And after 7 months of promoting his thank you pilgrimage, only 13 people had signed up. The travel agent called and was harassing him for a complete passenger list and payment in full. After her phone call, he said to Jesus, Lord, I think I made a mistake. I told you what I was going to do to thank you for what you've done for me, but I never asked you for your help. So now, instead of telling you what I'm going to do, I'm asking you to please help me gather these 100 people. Maybe we can dry your mother's tears. Almost instantly, the phone rang. It was George Volker, one of the 13 people who had signed up for Tom's trip. And he was inviting Tom to come to a Medjugorje prayer group at his church. There would be Mass, the Rosary, and a well-known speaker. Tom declined several times because of his overwhelming workload, so they hung up. And then Tom regretted it. Right away, he realized how insensitive he'd been, so he decided to go. Tom didn't find George, but the Mass and the Rosary were very beautiful. Then everyone headed downstairs to hear the speaker. But the pastor explained there was no speaker that night. He would usually fill in, but he had another meeting scheduled, and if they wanted to wait, he'd be back in about an hour. Father started out the door, stopped, and came back in. Pointing in Tom's direction, he said, hey, you, come here. Tom said, who, me? Yes, you, come here. Tom went up and he said, what do you want, Father? Father said, how about standing here talking to these people for about an hour? I'll be back. Tom went up and said, are you crazy, Father? What am I going to talk to them about? As Father was leaving, Tom could hear people say, who is he, Father? Who is he? Who is he? They were used to knowing the people they were going to have speaking. Father turned around, he stopped, and he turned around and he said, I have no idea who he is. And he turned around and walked away.
Oh, my goodness.
So suddenly, Tom got that same feeling he experienced in Bethlehem, Lourdes, and Fatima, and on that day at the boat. He was filled with emotion, and he said out loud, do I have a story in my heart? Yes, I guess I do. So he gave his first conversion story. He cried through most of the talk, and from what he could see through his tears, many of the people in the audience were crying with him. At the end of the talk, a man came up to me and he said, I can't believe I am going to Medjugorje with you. It was George Volker. And that night, about 47 people signed up for that pilgrimage. And the miracles kept piling up. When Tom came home and he woke me up to tell about this incredible evening, he was so excited. I yawned and said, that's nice. And I went back to sleep. On Monday, he went to work and worried that someone had found out about his talk. He was approached by a Pittsburgh Today producer. Pittsburgh Today was a KDK talk show, who said, "I understand you've been to Medjugorje." Right away, the warning bells go off. Tom said, yeah, why? Well, they were doing a program on Medjugorje, and they wanted him to be a guest. Tom said, "No, thank you. I am not going on any television show." Producer said, "Well, a friend of yours is going to be on the show." Tom said, "Oh, sure. Like I have any friends who know anything about Medjugorje." Producer said, "I think she's a neighbor of yours, Rita Klaus." Right then, Jesus reminded him of the statement he made to Rita about shouting from the roof about the miracles that God had provided. So trapped by his own words, Tom said to the producer, who was walking away by this time, "Wait a second, I'll be on your show." The show went well, and at the end of it, one of the hosts, Patrice King Brown, mentioned the June pilgrimage and told viewers where to call for information about Medjugorje. And no, he didn't get fired. When he got home, he found 46 messages on our answering machine, most of whom wanted to sign up for the pilgrimage. Some were invitations to speak at local parishes. After just 13 people in 7 months, think about this, 87 people signed up in 1 week. How does anyone explain that? There were two more pilgrimages that year as well, and requests for speaking engagements began to flow in regularly. Over the years, Tom led or produced nearly 40 pilgrimages to Medjugorje, and he had given more than 1,000 talks, mostly in churches. Well, no wonder I felt abandoned. All six of Tom's vacations were spent taking pilgrims to you-know-where, none of which included me, not because he didn't want me to go, it's because I just refused. Between KDKA, pilgrimages, and speaking engagements, he was never home. But I wasn't home much myself. As the director of marketing for the DiBartolo Corporation, I was in charge of 70 super regional malls all over the country. I was gone for much of 2 weeks in every month. Our lives had diverged drastically that I don't think I really cared whether we saw much of each other or not, because almost everything caused an argument. And the deeper Tom dove into learning anything and everything that he could about his faith, because he was basically starting from scratch, the more alienated I felt. I pondered the idea of separation many times. There were those constant rosaries, there were morning and evening prayers on his knees, his nightstand became an altar, he hung holy images all over the house, including a 7-foot-tall crucifix that he carried home on a plane from Mexico. He learned so much that was new and exciting to him, and I was the one he had to share it with, constantly, because now he was afraid for my eternal soul. I, on the other hand, was afraid for my sanity. Sure, I was happy that he was healed of arthritis and other problems in Medjugorje, but it did not change my life the way it changed his, but it just kept changing our life together. Because God was all he could think about or talk about, we started losing friends, and it seemed to me like we were losing everything. Tom badgered me into going to church with him on Sundays. I didn't participate. I just went to make him happy. Soon this began to be a problem for me because Tom was taking everything the scripture said so literally. And until now, I never realized how often the gospels tell us to go out and give everything to the poor. So now every time we went to mass and one of those gospels was read, fear would strike my heart because I think, oh no, how much is he going to put in the basket today? I worried and I complained. I was uncomfortable and I didn't know this man who was masquerading as my husband. He was praying too much, preaching too much, working too hard for God, and using up all his vacation time on pilgrimages. I questioned whether I still loved him. And how could it get any worse? But it did. Out of the blue, one winter's day, Tom announced to me that he was going to quit his job as the chief photojournalist of a major TV station and work full-time for God. I was a little disturbed, to say the least. Half of our income gone. I knew he was unhappy at KDKA, but still, whew, that was drastic. And then he told me he was going to write a book. Well, I just laughed. I said, "You write a book? You can't read a book." I really thought that was funny. So there we were, living with this conversion for 4 years, and I couldn't believe God was tearing us apart like this. I knew that if I made Tom choose between God and me, that God would win. So I never really tried never to push him over that line. Although, many times I came within inches. Sure enough, in March of 1991, with no support from me, Tom resigned from KDKA to go on the road for Jesus. And in June of 1992, that book he said he would write was published. Its title is Apostles of the Last Days. And today there are more than 85,000 of those books in print. Back in 1990, Tom did try to get me to go to Medjugorje with his next trip, and I refused to go. I told him I only had 2 weeks of vacation and I wasn't about to spend it praying in a communist country. Typical of Tom, he refused to give up. After a couple of months of saying no, I told him I would go if we spent a second week traveling through Italy. Okay, that worked. I realized later it was his greatest desire to get me to Medjugorje so that my life would be radically altered as his was, to experience what he experienced. But it just didn't happen. I got through it okay, but barely. And I was still the same old me. And I was sure he was profoundly disappointed. A month later, on August 4th, Tom's birthday, we were married again, this time in the Catholic Church, because Tom had never stopped working toward that annulment of his first marriage since the day of his conversion. Whatever possessed me to say yes the second time, by the way, was a mystery to me, because I still had a good 5 years before I finally understood what this was all about. That year, Tom also founded Gospa Missions. Gospa means Our Lady in Croatian, to evangelize the world's people to the Catholic Church through the Word, and actions such as conferences, newsletters, pilgrimages, presentations, our religious goods store, publishing, and more. He was using our home as his headquarters and our bank account until he could accept donations. But what was it that kept us together through all this? After so many years of fighting against all that was happening to Tom, what made me stop fighting so hard? Well, it wasn't until 1995 that the first big breakthrough came, when all of a sudden I realized that even though Tom had quit his job 4 years ago, and I had worried so much because half of our income had evaporated, that I never missed the money. Tom didn't miss it because he never worried about money, but I never missed the money. I couldn't wrap my head around that, so how is that possible? Even though he was using our own funds to operate Gospa Missions, it never caused a money problem. But how could it be? Maybe God's trying to talk to me through my pocketbook. Well, I was listening. He was telling me that there's nothing to be afraid of. I began to believe that. He was helping us in so many ways. And then there was all that praying. Tom kept telling me he was praying and fasting to keep me out of purgatory. I said, okay, I'll take that too. But he was also a nicer guy, more considerate and loving, and 10 times more helpful around the house, which was a big deal to me. I liked him better as a person, even though I still missed the fun guy I married the first time around. One day I finally woke up and realized how petty and small my complaints really were. There were so many real husband problems I could have had to whine about. Sickness or death or infidelity, drug addiction, alcoholism, abusive behavior, those are all problems. What did I really have to complain about? My husband's a real creep. He goes to Mass every day? He prays too much? He says, I love you far too often? I began to understand, though, what real love really means. To me, it was putting first the happiness and the well-being of the person you say you love, which I don't know that I've ever done before. And as soon as I realized that, it was life-changing for me. Except, you know, there are always other circumstances. Right about that time I started softening up, I came home from work one day in 1995, almost 8 years into Tom's conversion, with bad news. I'd lost my job because a new senior vice president wanted to work with his own team. Having made it all the way to assistant vice president of marketing, I couldn't believe this was happening to me. And I didn't know how to break it to Tom. Now we had no regular income. So I just came out with it and I said, honey, I lost my job. You'll never believe what Tom said. He looked up to heaven and said, thank you, God. Excuse me? Thank you, God? Where did that compassionate, loving husband go all of a sudden? Oh, he was still there. He was just thanking God for answering his prayers. For nearly 8 years, he'd been praying and fasting for this to happen, and he was happy that I would be around more. He was working so hard and traveling to all his speaking engagements alone, handling all his book sales himself, that he needed help. Right away, he said, "Come with me on my next speaking tour. Puerto Rico, Florida, Alaska." I said, "Okay." It was still really hard for me to accept, though, totally what had happened, because I wasn't sure how I was going to fit into all this, or even if I should fit in. But working together for gospel missions, we found out we were pretty good as a team. We were together every day, 24 hours a day, and we were happy and we were doing good work. After that, I went with Tom on every engagement he had. We traveled the world, and one important trip was to Nigeria in November of 1995. It's an amazing story and way too long to tell here, but Tom had been invited to speak at a diocesan weekend gathering by Father Peter Obway, a Nigerian who'd been studying at Duquesne. This is where Tom saw children who needed help in every way. He came home and he decided to build an orphanage. St. Joseph Orphanage School was built in 2000 and in use before it was even finished, housing 150 orphans and around 600 students at the school. In 2006, Tom founded a second nonprofit to handle the orphanage part of GOSPA and called it Abode for Children. In 2007, Tom agreed to do a similar project in the Diocese of Gunder, India, under the request of their bishop. Girls and boys' orphanages, school, parish church, rectory, convent, the whole deal. It was also in the summer of 2006 that Tom began to experience back pain that kept increasing. The ultimate diagnosis was multiple myeloma, a cancer of the bone marrow that neither one of us had ever heard of. Tom entered a clinical trial in New York City and responded well to the test drug, and even went into remission. And at one point, he told the doctor he wanted to stop taking the drug because the side effects had begun to accumulate. So for about 3 years, life went on. But in 2010, things began to change. He was in and out of the hospital because all kinds of complications began arising, and he spent much of that year in bed. And I told some very good friends that one day, with Tom this ill, I had nothing left to look forward to. My life was over. I had the nerve to feel sorry for myself. It appalls me even to this day. On January 31st, 2011, Tom was admitted to a hospital, and between nursing homes and rehab and more hospitals, he never came home again. That meant I had to go and live with him. I stayed with him no matter where he was. I slept in his room every night and was with him all day. Some nights there were no beds, so I slept on the floor. But I wasn't leaving him alone. And I was not a popular person at any of those places. I was a very vocal advocate, and I even fired a doctor or two. If I did have to run out on an errand, I would give him a kiss and tell him I loved him with all my heart. One day he said back to me, "I love you with all my soul." That absolutely stunned me, and I was overwhelmed by the feeling of love that statement brought to me. I loved him with my physical heart, and he loved me with his spiritual soul. The one thing most important to him, his eternal soul. I soon realized that statement I made about having nothing to look forward to was the stupidest and most selfish thing I had ever said. The truth was that I treasured every moment that I spent with Tom. I was deeply indebted to God for giving me the time and the resources to be there with him when and if he needed me. Tom died with the people he loved around him, with everyone praying the rosary. I'm not sure it can get any better than that. But he was ready, he was prepared, and he was looking forward to it. I can only pray that he was at peace with leaving everything he started here on earth in the hands of a wife who loves him very much, but who gave him a whole lot of trouble. It's definitely not easy for me, but as St. Luke writes, "From whom much has been given, much will be expected." And I've been given a lot. I thank God for giving me Tom, who loved me and protected me and gave me at least a fighting chance to save my immortal soul. Because without him in my life, God only knows where I'd be now. Thank you.